Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
If a friend asks how you're doing, and you say,
I'm okay.
When the truth is,
I don't want my problems to burden anyone.
Or you say,
hang it in there.
Because
if I ask for help, they'll just think I'm weak.
Then this is your sign to call, text, or chat. 988 for free, confidential support. Anytime. You don't have to hide how you feel.
Welcome to True Crime Garage. Wherever you are, whatever you are doing, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Nick, and with me, as always, is a man that knows that it takes a little more than a week to prepare a good impromptu speech. He is the captain.
I will speak at weddings and I'll speak at funerals. Just call my agent. It's good to be seen and it's good to see you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for telling a friend.
Tonight we are drinking Fat Tire Belgian White Ale by the New Belgian Brewing Company, Garage Grade, 3 3/4 bottle caps out of 5.
This is not the first time we've drank Fat Tire in the garage, and it won't be the last.
5.2% ABV, and you can certainly taste the hints of oranges and coriander. It's a really good pick-me-up beer, and I know some people turn up a nose to this, but it's a great beer to drop an orange slice into as well. And this week's beer was brought to us by a handful of great Garage listeners. First up, we have Patrick in Southeastern Massachusetts.
And a big shout out to Leanne in one of my favorite places to visit, Maui, Hawaii.
Next, we have a long distance cheers to Stacy in Castro Valley, California. And also in California, we have Kim in Salinas, California.
And from Tecumseh, Kansas, we have a big shout out to Nicole. We like your gym.
And I want to give a thank you to Isabella in Chelmer, Australia. And last but not least, a big shout out to Danielle in Dayton and her mother, Patty, in Canton, Ohio. So thanks to everybody for filling up the fridge for this week's show. If you want to help us out with next week's beer run, go to truecrimegarage.com and click on the donate button.
And check out our t-shirts on the store page at truecrimegarage.com. We're going to be working on new merchandise with, you know, some beer mugs, some coffee mugs, some stickers, a bunch of stuff coming in 2018.
And something very exciting, Captain. Most of you out there will know this already, but we have some special information. We have CrimeCon that is coming up the first weekend of May.
Yes.
And you can check out details at CrimeCon.com. And guess what? If you use our little code here, TC Garage, you can save yourself 10% on your tickets for this year's CrimeCon.
Yes, so sign up. Come hang out with us. We'll be drinking at the hotel bar. Hotel Motel Holiday Inn.
Well, and if you want to save some money, make sure you use code TC Garage at CrimeCon.com to get your tickets for this year's CrimeCon 2018.
All right, that's enough of the business. Gather around, grab a chair, grab a fat tire. Let's talk some true crime.
In January of 1984, someone or someones They were going around to different homes and attacking people in their homes in the Aurora and Lakewood, Colorado areas. Now, one thing we have tasked ourselves with for today, Captain, is there are several common questions regarding these attacks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we should lay it out here quickly before we get to the questions, but in the first attack, we have a husband and wife that are attacked in the middle of their night, in the middle of the night in their bedroom. Right. They both survived the attack. The second attack happens just days later, where we have a 50-year-old woman who's attacked inside of her townhome. She's raped and killed. The third attack, a woman is sexually assaulted and attacked in her garage. She basically has no memory.
Yeah, she's in a coma for weeks.
Yeah, of the attack or the attacker. And then the final attack that we can see, the fourth attack, is the Bennett family. In the middle of the night, somebody snuck into the Bennett family home. A fight ensued between the attacker and Bruce Bennett, the father. And the attack left the father dead, the mother dead, the oldest child dead, and the youngest child was sent to the hospital who suffered horrible injuries.
Mm-hmm.
And it took many surgeries to try to put it so that she could try to have a normal life after this attack and having lost her family. She would eventually go on to live with her grandmother, Constance Bennett. Now, the questions that we've seen that are common to these attacks in this cold case from 1984 Colorado is, were the four attacks connected? And if there were no signs of forced entry, how did the intruder get into the homes of these people? How did the killer know the victims? Or if not, how did he choose these particular people or houses? What was the motive for these attacks? And the killings, the attacks and the killings ended with the Bennett family. Why? Why did the killer stop? Did the killer himself die? Or did he just stop killing? Or did he move to another state? So several things to get to here today. And I think if we can answer a lot of these questions, we might be able to have a better idea of who, in fact, perpetrated these attacks.
Well, let's start with the obvious question first. Were these attacks connected?
Well, that was a question that many people had speculated on for nearly 20 years. It was the thought of locals and the thought of a lot of armchair detectives that it's likely that all four of these attacks were connected. Mm. I mean, we have the simple fact of we can't find any sign of forced entry in any of these four attacks.
Mm-hmm.
It appears that the same weapon was used or the same type of weapon, a hammer or something similar, was used in all four attacks.
Correct.
Where we have either a single female or a family being attacked. So the victimology is similar. The gaining entry to the home might be similar. And we also have the same weapon. So it would look that these attacks that all occurred, mind you, within the span of 13 days in roughly the same area, and that they must be connected.
Yeah. And I think because the timeline is so short, one would assume.
The problem that armchair detectives have had for those 20 years, or nearly 20 years, I should say, is that the details of the cases. We don't have hardly any information regarding the Hobbins Child case,
mm-hmm.
and that could be the first attack. We do get some more information regarding the second attack, that's the death and murder of Patricia Smith. And then there's a ton of evidence or a ton of information out there on the Bennett family murders. And that's the cold case that kind of resonated with the community and with the people of Colorado. That's the one that they would remind you of the anniversary of it. And if there had been any movement in that case since it had occurred in 1984.
Well, one out of the four attacks, two of the attacks, people survived.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, in three of the attacks, somebody survived. But the Bennett family cases, you know, it's pretty much the whole family.
Yeah, and in all of those attacks, we don't really have anybody that's able to describe the attacker. You know, so if we would have had a surviving member of the family in each case go describe the attacker to us, we could determine just based off of that if they were in fact connected or potentially connected.
Yes, and I think I'm going to assume, and we'll probably get into this a little bit later, but I'm going to assume that they had some details about the attacker but not enough where that they could, you know, make a sketch or anything.
The only details that I could find, and I do, I'll give them to you now, but we'll circle back to it later, was from the first attack, from that Hobbins child attack. There is a rumor floating around, and I want to be clear that I feel that it could be a rumor. There's information out there to suggest that Kimberly may have seen the attacker inside their home before she was hit, before she was struck over the head. And in this situation, she describes an African-American male who was, in her words, well, I can't say for certain that these are her words. That's why I want to be clear that this might be a rumor, was that she had stated that the man was well over 6 foot. And in these same reports, I've also seen the word enormous used to describe this potential attacker. But what
I heard he was a tall piece of shit or enormous piece of shit.
What we would later learn, like I said, nearly 20 years later, this was in 2002, that they announced, remember, there was DNA collected at several of the crime scenes. Mm-hmm. The DNA of the person who murdered the Bennetts was found at the Bennett family home, as well as the person that murdered Patricia Smith in her home.
Yeah.
They announced in 2002 that the DNA from both of these crime scenes matched the DNA collected at the other crime scene.
Right. So those two are at least connected.
Correct. We can say with scientific proof that those two cases are connected. And those, in fact, involve all of the actual murders. That only leaves the other two cases where people were attacked, left for dead, but, in fact, recovered later at the hospital. Now, in those situations, there was a bloody boot print that was found in the Bennett's garage, okay?
So it was OJ?
Yeah, it was OJ Simpson. what they did was they actually cut this boot print out and saved it and preserved it for many, many years, probably still to this day.
Like Bigfoot.
The thing here is there was a similar, if not identical, boot print that was left in the garage of Donna Dixon.
Mm-hmm. So that would connect that one as well.
Yeah, I found two reports of this. So obviously this is not something that has been widely reported, but it appears that we have scientific evidence that all the murders are in fact connected. And it's very likely that whoever attacked Donna Dixon in her garage was the same person that killed the Bennett family.
Is there any information about the first attack as far as missing items?
No. There's
like, because some of the other cases, it will say, you know, she had diamond rings or diamond earrings or something, and those were taken. But it seems like with the first one, there is no report of items missing.
Okay, so yeah, not only is there no report of items missing, but we also have some other lack of evidence or lack of information regarding the Hobbins child attack. We don't, other than it being stated that no forced entry was used to get into the home, we don't know how, you know, we don't know how they either determined that or B, the way that this person gained entry. Mm-hmm. What we do know is that the two victims were sleeping in their bedrooms. Mm-hmm. So they didn't answer the door. We can gather that much. As you stated, we don't know if there was anything taken from the home. We don't know if Kimberly was sexually assaulted like some of the other females were in other attacks.
Right. Doesn't mean she wasn't. It just wasn't reported.
Correct. And we don't know how much of a, if there was any struggle at all before the actual attacks occurred. So what we heard in the first trailer there where I'm describing the actual attack, a bit of that is dramatized, okay, because there is no information. The information that's received that I have found would suggest that they were in their bedroom sleeping when the attack occurred. This makes me question if Kimberly, in fact, even would have seen the attacker at all.
Right.
It makes me question that was she struck before she could have had the opportunity to see him? Or was the room dark enough that she couldn't make anything out regarding this person before she was struck over the head? You're talking about she was either struck over the head before she had the opportunity to open her eyes or immediately after doing so. And suffering such a terrible head injury also would make you question, or me anyway, question the validity of what she thinks she may have saw.
Yeah, you're not calling her a liar. You're just saying, again, who knows? I mean, the attacker could be wearing a mask. The attacker could be wearing face paint. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're breaking into a house at night, is it really that absurd to think that maybe the person would be wearing face paint? You wake up.
Or right, a ski mask.
Ski mask. You wake up. You're in the dark. Your eyes are adjusting. Maybe she believes she saw an African-American male. But like you said, I'm with you. How much can you trust what information she's putting out there? I'd say probably none of it.
We know that this was the middle of the night. We know that this attack occurred in January of Colorado. I can't state what the exact temperature was that night, but I can tell you that I wouldn't put it out of question that the person was wearing something to cover their face, not only for as a disguise, but to protect themselves from the elements. You know, it being January in Colorado. Anyway, so the other thing, though, here, Captain, is I came across two detective interviews that occurred over the years. Both of them have stated several times during these interviews that they believe that the Bennett family murders were connected to two other cases. One that we said was proven by DNA, and the second one, they wouldn't say it directly. The Donna Dixon attack, but I'm assuming that's what they mean, that they are pretty convinced that the three of them are connected. The problem, as we're pointing out, is the Hobbins child attack has so little information.
Right, but their evidence is the DNA connection and the boot print.
Yes. Okay, so this is pretty interesting here, Captain. Armed with the DNA evidence that they announced in 2002, now let's go to June of 2002. The then district attorney, Jim Peters, he obtained a John Doe arrest warrant, charging John Doe, this would be the person whose DNA was left at those two crime scenes, with 18 counts, including 4 first-degree murder charges and a bunch of sexual assault charges. Why is this important? Because this is interesting because they have this person's DNA. They don't know who he is. But when there's an opportunity that at some point this guy could commit another crime, could get picked up for some reason where they would be required to take his DNA, enter that information into certain databases, and it would link the two. Now, the problem here is if he were arrested in Aurora or Lakewood, it's very likely that they would keep him immediately. The thing here is, let's say this guy committed a crime in Maine or in Florida or in Washington, and he's picked up somewhere and they collect his DNA and it hits in one of these databases. Well, now the local authorities of wherever this man is arrested can go, you know what? We know we only picked you up on a DUI and we would typically release you for this, but we can't release you because there's an arrest warrant for you in the state of Colorado.
Right.
So he would be held until he could be extradited and charged with these and brought to trial.
But there was another thing learned by this, right?
Yeah, by the release of these, of the DNA being connected between the two cases. The other reason why this is so valuable, and one thing that they told us when they released this information, was that the police actually spent a lot of time when investigating the murders of the Bennett family members. They spent a ton of time looking at actual family members of the Bennetts, of having committed this murder, the triple murder.
Because it was so heinous.
Well, not only that, but I think it's more for this point that earlier that night, that same night that they were attacked, just hours before, they had that birthday party.
Right.
Where they had a bunch of people that they knew and a bunch of family members to their home. And I think that the police were working on a theory that maybe either someone had returned to the home. Like I could go back to the home hours later and go, hey, I forgot my hat, or I forgot my coat, and gain entry into the home that way.
Yeah, or you could be like, I forgot my wig.
The other thing, though, too, is the thought that maybe somebody had concealed themselves somewhere in the home waiting for the family to go to sleep and then decided to attack them in the middle of the night. The DNA evidence was used to test against people that they were looking into, whether it be Bennett family members or people that knew the Bennetts. Maybe it's people that worked at the family furniture store. Mm-hmm. They were able to use this DNA to clear those people.
And with this information, we could definitively say that three of the four attacks are connected. Then the question becomes, how did this intruder get into the house if there's never a sign of forced entry?
Okay, so I was able to track down a couple of different news articles that took place, that were written well after the crimes took place. This is from 1994 from the Rocky Mountain News, and I'm not going to read the entire article, but there are some things that I think that we should highlight here. Mm-hmm. And in this article, the person that is being interviewed is Constance Bennett. Now, in this article, she's going by Connie. I'm assuming that that's what her friends and family actually called her. But she's recounting what took place 10 years ago mm-hmm. from this interview. And she's stating that the next morning, when the couple had failed to show up at work, she remembers thinking that she better go check on them because of something like carbon monoxide poisoning or a carbon monoxide leak in the house.
Yeah.
She stated that when she arrived at the home, she walked up the sidewalk. She saw Deborah's purse lying on the front lawn with its contents spilled out. Once inside the home, she found Bruce inside the bloody spattered house on a stairway leading from the main floor to a lower level. He was bludgeoned and his throat was cut. This is a direct quote from Constance or Connie, stating, "I called 911. I couldn't remember the address," she said. "I had to run outside to get it. I was hysterical, I guess." And we'll get back into a bit of that in a little bit. But the other thing that she states here is she says after she called 911, the important information here is that she says 10 years after the attack, "I believe whoever committed this crime crept through the unlocked garage door in the quiet darkness, maybe on a mission to kill, could have been looking for money, maybe high on drugs." Mm. And she states that she doesn't think that it was anyone who knew the Bennetts. Now, I took this information, then I looked at this other article that was found from the Denver Post in September of 2003. And this article is different. This one is written by a neighbor who is kind of, he doesn't talk so much about the crime itself,
yeah.
But he's kind of talking about the neighborhood and about his family and what having lived next door or lived across the street from this triple homicide and how it has affected them and their neighborhood. And he's stating, you know, that ever since that day, this guy and his family are dog people. They always own dogs. Before the attacks.
Good people.
He said that they own Irish setters. Mm-hmm. They had always had Irish setters before, but now after the Bennett family was killed, that they own Dobermans, that they got a more aggressive dog because of this attack. Now, the thing here is, though, that he states he had been watching A&E's Cold Crime Files one night before writing this article, and he stated that he thought that the almost forgotten Bennett case was a perfect, would be perfect for this TV show, A&E's Cold Crime Files. So he was kind of thinking back and reflecting on what he remembers of the crime in that night. And he says, "The memory of that night was burnt in my mind. The garage door was open all night. He died of a slit throat. His wife and daughter were bludgeoned to death. Little Vanessa survived." So in the case of the Bennett family, we have the mother speculating that the killer entered through the unlocked door from the garage. Mm-hmm. Nowhere in that article does she state that the garage door was open when she arrived at the scene. However, we have a neighbor stating that memory's burnt in my mind. The garage door was open all night. So what I think we can gather from that is that it's very likely that the Bennetts accidentally left their garage door open. Most people don't lock the man door that goes from your whatever room into your garage.
That's sexist.
And it's likely that the killer walked in through the garage, through that unlocked door and started walking into the home, caused some noise. He woke up the family. And Bruce comes down the steps and they fight. Now, the reason why I read that other thing about Constance saying that she called 911 but couldn't remember the address. Remember, they had only moved into that home about 3 months before they were attacked and killed. So it's, you know, not unheard of that the mother wouldn't remember the address. They had only lived there a short time. But the reason why I read that bit was one thing that I had always wondered about this case, Captain, was if this fight would have taken some time between Bruce and the attacker and the intruder. I had always wondered why Deborah, his wife, hadn't called 911. And I had always speculated that possibly the killer, before entering the home, had cut the phone line outside. We now know that that wasn't the case. He never cut the phone line because that's the same phone line that Constance later used to call 911 to report her son and his family having been attacked.
Right.
Okay, so how did the killer gain entry into these different homes? I think here, we can't say with definitive proof that he entered through the garage door, but then I started looking at the Patricia Smith case.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, she lived in a townhome. And I guess when I pictured this in my mind, I was picturing, you know, like a condo. But what I started doing was I got on Google and I Googled her address. And I couldn't find that.
Creepy.
It would only show me like the bank of townhomes, let's say. You have the main street there and then you would turn in and you have multiple townhomes. Mm-hmm. They all share the same numbered address, but they are distinct by a letter. So I couldn't confirm which one was actually hers, the home that she was killed in. What I could confirm was looking at that bank of townhomes, they all had garages. I just assumed her home never had a garage because her daughter describes pulling up and seeing her mother's car outside, parked outside.
Right.
That doesn't mean that she didn't park her car outside, open the garage door, and then go in through the door, leaving that door unlocked.
Right.
And again, she could have heard her attacker come into the home. She goes downstairs to investigate, or she's still upstairs by the time he gets upstairs to attack her.
The evidence keeps pouring in. At this point, the facts are undeniable. It's an open and shut case. Monopoly Go is the most fun you can have in a mobile game. Everyone is still talking about Monopoly Go, for a good reason. It is an absolute hit. Millions of people pass Go every day because this game is always bringing something new to the table. Like countless crazy tournaments, you can join with your friends as partners or teams. Or timed events, offering bonuses like massive multipliers or rent frenzies to help you get huge rewards. And there's so many rewards to discover. Rare stickers you can trade with friends to complete albums. Delightful emojis to taunt people with when you raid their riches. Unique playing pieces and so much more. The verdict is in. With Monopoly Go, there's something new to discover every time you play. So don't miss out. Go download it now free on the App Store and Google Play.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. When we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down.
If you're thinking of starting therapy, I highly recommend that you give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/garage today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/garage. This show is proudly sponsored by BetterHelp. Check out BetterHelp.com/garage today. Do you want to set your child up for success? Of course you do. That's why you need to check out IXL Learning today. IXL Learning is an online learning program for kids covering math, language arts, science, and social studies. IXL is designed to help them really understand and master topics in a fun way. It's powered by advanced algorithms. IXL gives the right help to each kid, no matter the age or personality. There's one site for all kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. Kids could use it at home on their computer or on an app on your phone or a tablet. No more grading those worksheets. IXL grades everything for you. 1 in 4 students in the U.S. are learning with IXL. IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. I love recommending IXL learning. Kids can learn at home or on the go. And all my friends and family that are using it absolutely love it because it's so easy to set up and so easy to use. And even the kids that I've recommended it to their parents have told me, hey, Captain, thank you. I was having problems in math and my parents couldn't help me, but IXL could. Do you want to get your kids back on track or do you just want to get your kids ahead? Do so with IXL Learning. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And True Crime Garage listeners get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when you sign up today at IXL.com/garage. Visit IXL.com/garage to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price. Check out IXL.com/garage today.
Warmer, sunnier days are calling. Fuel up for them with Factor's no prep, no mess meals. Meet your wellness goals in time for summer thanks to the menu of chef-crafted meals with options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. Factor's fresh, never frozen meals are dietitian approved and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. So no matter how busy you are, you'll always have time to enjoy nutritious, great tasting meals. With 35 different meals and more than 60 add-ons to choose from every week, you'll always have new flavors to explore. Crush your wellness goals this May with dietitian approved meals and ingredients that you can trust. Make your day delicious. From breakfast to dessert, stay fueled with easy, nutritious options. Treat yourself to restaurant-quality meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, and blackened salmon. I am new to Factor, and I have been loving every minute of it. I have a problem, and it's called lunch. Some days I need a pack of lunch, and some days I work from home. Whether I'm at home or whether I'm on the go, Factor is fueling my lunch from now on. Head to factormeals.com/truecrimegarage50 and use code truecrimegarage50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next month. That's code truecrimegarage50 at factormeals.com/truecrimegarage50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next month, while your subscription is active.
All right. Cheers, mates.
Cheers. A little more information here, Captain, before we get back to our questions that we want to answer for this. The Aurora Cold Case Squad, there is a detective there, Steve Connor. He asked the Parabon Nano Labs company, this is a company based in Virginia, to use its newly developed technology to create an image of the perpetrator based on DNA predictions to determine the suspect's ancestry, eye color, hair color, freckling, and face shape. Now, remember, some of you will remember we've discussed this on cases before. This is newer technology, and they had DNA from two of the crime scenes. This is that snapshot DNA imaging, and we've discussed this on several other cases. One that comes to mind is the April Tinsley case. There are some things to discuss here, Captain. The images generated as requested by the detective show what the perpetrator may look like. Key word here we need to use is may look like, but it shows what the perpetrator may have looked like at the ages of 25 and 55 years old. Now, keep in mind, we don't know the age of the offender. These are just two ages picked by the detective at his request.
Yeah. there's a part of me that likes that they do this, but the more information I find about this, because basically what it's doing is it's coming up with a composite sketch based off of DNA. But this DNA doesn't tell you certain, it only tells you, it's so vague. So it's almost to me where it's like, do the DNA test, do a description, but I don't necessarily think they should do an actual drawing.
Well, you're right there, Captain. I actually think they should do the drawing, but the reason why I say that you're right is that as much as this could help your investigation locating this perpetrator, it could hurt you in a sense that there's a chance that the actual offender today may not resemble either of these pictures given. And meaning it could hurt you in the fact that where you and I on the street might look at a guy and say, you know what? I know he lived in the Aurora area back in 84 and he suddenly moved and he's been here for 30 years, but he doesn't look anything like the guy. Well, why would he not look anything like the guys? Because you have some pretty generalities here of based off of what the person would look like. Let's say the older image showing him at age 55. Well, this is showing this to me. It only shows the face, you know, from the neck up. And this appears to be somebody that would be of average weight. Well, one thing that would change his general facial appearance simply would be if he was thinner than this or more heavy set than this.
Yeah.
Also, you can't factor in how hard of a life has this person lived. Is this somebody that's been drinking constantly for the past 30 years and may have wrinkles and not look anything like this, or a smoker, or somebody that's tan, or
What if he was using his apartment for a place for smokers to go to?
Yes, we've seen the effects that has had on Cosmo Kramer.
Hideous, Jerry. Hideous. Look away.
So the cold case detective, he states that one thing he wants us to focus on is not so much the image that has been created, but that we should focus more on the physical description that is given because of this information, and stating that we are, you know, we're looking at a Caucasian person. This is somebody that would be believed to have the ancestry of Northern and or Central European ancestry. They have fair to very fair skin color.
Mm-hmm.
Eye color would be green or blue eyes. Hair color would be brown or blonde hair, and would have few to some freckles. So obviously we can't figure out how tall the person is, how much they may weigh, what kind of lifestyle choices that they've made since then that could change their appearance in some different ways. Talking about Colorado and talking about this snapshot DNA, I did see one where Colorado used this technology to create an image of somebody. And this was a person that I believe he was guilty of a couple of rapes and had moved away. And somebody saw the image of this person and sure enough made the right phone call. And this guy was picked up and they were able to determine that it was in fact him. The funny thing here, well, not the funny thing, but the thing here, Captain, is the guy, he did look almost exactly like the image,
maybe I should take back my...
No, I don't think so. I think it's right to have a little bit of concern. We've seen it used in several cases. I've only seen one case where it's actually led to the apprehension of the actual individual.
And this is why I said that I think they had some evidence that this murderer was Caucasian.
Okay.
Because, you know, one of the things that Steve Connor said was this gave us proof that they were Caucasian.
Oh, that they had some thought that this was a Caucasian male, and then this DNA evidence proved that thought.
And I kind of wondered, maybe it could have just been a speculation, obviously, but he said that now we have definitive evidence. And so, again, that makes me feel like they knew something beforehand.
Where it makes you wonder, had somebody seen something? Was there some kind of eyewitness that saw somebody fleeing the scene?
Mm-hmm.
Or did somebody see possibly, maybe another motorist happened to see somebody driving or tailing Donna Dixon in a car behind her, and it was all I can tell you was it was a white guy.
Or one of the people that survived, you know, later said, hey, I believe it was a white guy.
Possibly. You know what I mean? The interesting thing here is we can only speculate as far as with the survivors go. So we, according to the information we have that was reported in the papers and the media, the three-year-old that survived, she has no recollection of the attack. Now, is that simply that police said, you know what? We're going to state that in the media so that this guy doesn't come out of the woodwork and come looking for the lone survivor of the Bennett family attack.
Right.
You know, she's a minor. We also have Donna Dixon. Could be the same thing. They could be protecting her. I have heard one of the detectives say in an interview that Donna Dixon has no recollection of the attack. As far as Donna Dixon knows, she got out of her car, and next thing she knows, she woke up a week later in a hospital bed and has no clue what happened. You bring up an interesting thing here, though, because we said earlier that there was some loosey-goosey information out there that possibly Kimberly Hobbinschild had stated that the attacker that attacked her and her husband, James, in their bedroom that night in January 84 was a large African-American man.
Mm-hmm.
And with this DNA evidence, what that would point out to us is one of two things. Either A, this is not connected. These three other attacks are not connected to the first attack.
Right.
Or B, for whatever reason, she thinks that she saw a black man and it wasn't possible. It was actually this guy, and it's all four of them are connected.
Well, and after, 170-some episodes?
Yeah.
With you, I'm starting to learn a couple things about what fascinates you about cases, and you're a sucker for letters.
Yeah, well, yes, I am. If I'm a sucker for
love letters.
When a killer would communicate with the media or the police,
mm-hmm.
Whether it be letters or through phone calls, and you're kind of in a roundabout way getting to what I know. You know, we need to get to at this point is the bloody letters that were left at the Bennett crime scene.
Yeah.
And could this be, when we say letters, though, we mean, could this be the name of the killer that was left on the body of one of the victims? This wasn't released to the public until 2015. The way that this works is this. So when the killer lifted Melissa's body, this is the seven-year-old. When he lifted Melissa's bloody body from her bed, there were letters embroidered on this person's shirt that were transferred in blood to the little girl's pajamas.
Mm-hmm.
So investigators have always believed that the letters could identify the killer's name or possibly the business where he worked or had worked at one time. This was something... Regarding the release of this information, this was something that police and detectives, they debated for many, many years on whether or not they should release this information to the public.
Yeah.
Because, okay, so the arguments for both sides would be, one, the killer is probably very likely unaware that he left this evidence at the crime scene. And this could be deadly information. When you find this person and you have him in the interrogation room, is he, once you finally present this information to him, how's he going to be able to explain it away?
Right.
So that could help to make an arrest. Then on the other, you have where if he knows about this information going into the questioning, he may come up with a plausible excuse or just be set off ready to deny it emphatically from the get-go.
Right, because he knows the information's out there.
So regarding this, this was something that the police actually worked on.
Right, but the other side of the coin was that if you don't release it, that you have such a time gap that, you know, if he worked for a business that is now closed,
mm-hmm.
or closed way back in, let's say, 85, then like if you would have released this information in 85 or 84, that more people would be aware of this business.
Right, and you have 30 years that have gone by the time they finally do release the information. This information may be no good maybe it was only good to somebody that's not around anymore.
Right.
That could have provided you the proper tip. The police, they did work this information for quite some time before releasing it to the public. they actually sent it to two different labs to try to decipher what the letters were or what they actually said. They sent it to a Canadian lab who came up with the letters PETAW-C, as in cat. So PETAW-C. Now, the strange thing here, though, Captain, is they sent it to, like we said, two labs. The other was an Arizona lab, which came up with something completely different. They came up with R-I-C-H-A-R. So the second, A-I-C-H-A-R, could be like the name Richard or Richards or Richardson. So why would they come up with two completely different things? Well, okay, you got to keep in mind a couple of factors here. First of all, the obvious that would be something you and I and other garage listeners could probably figure out is, depending on how the killer picked up this girl, how he was holding her when the letters transferred in blood, could mean several things. Either the letters would be upside down, they would be backwards, simple things like that that you and I and others could fairly, you know, easily figure out.
Right.
The other issue, though, too, is think about how this is not like you're taking a, like you're taking a stamp, you know, as something you dip in ink and then stamping it onto a piece of paper and it dries immediately and it stays there. No, this is something that blood-soaked clothing the victim is wearing, potentially blood-soaked clothing that the killer is wearing as well. There could have been, and there's hours before the bodies are discovered. So you're talking about swelling of these letters. You're also talking about distortion of these letters. And from the reports that I have been able to find that talk about the details of this actual layout of these letters would describe that the way that her pajamas were at the time that they believed that those letters transferred to her clothing was that there would have been folds on those pajamas.
Right. Not only just folds, but you're going to have also a situation where he might have picked up the victim, pressed his body against her, released her a little bit, pressed his body against her again. See what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Or moved. So, or moved her, you know, friction.
Right. So the first time if you press your body against, and then when you release, if then her pajamas fold in a different manner, this is why there could be such confusion.
Right, right. So again, those the two that the labs came up with, one is PETAW-C and the other is RICHAR. Very interesting stuff here. It doesn't really lead me to anything. But then again, I'm also not aware of companies back then, you know, companies in the area back then in 83, 84. Mm-hmm. I do like the chance of a possible name of Richard or Richards or Richardson, something to that effect. But back to our questions, Captain. You know, we talked about the DNA, we connecting some of these cases. We've talked about the how would the killer gain entry to the homes with no signs of forced entry. Personal belief of mine is that the killer came in through the garage door. Mm-hmm. I know that when you and I are roughly the same age, and I know in my neighborhood growing up when I was a kid, oftentimes you could tell if your friend and his family were home during the daytime by simply looking out your door or going down the street on your bike and seeing if their garage door was open.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I was growing up, that, and I grew up in the late 80s, early 90s, you know.
I mean, late 60s.
And so I wouldn't be surprised if it was a similar situation in this neighborhood in Colorado, in these neighborhoods in Colorado. And you could simply have a situation where the Bennetts, having a busy house full of people for the birthday party, forgot or failed to close the garage door for whatever reason before going to bed.
Right. Well, and it's a good possibility that, oh, we're having this little birthday party for our daughter and we're having some friends and family over and we're drinking a little bit, you know, and then you get your kids to bed and maybe the husband, you know, passed out on the couch or whatever, you know.
Personally, I believe, and it's just my speculation, but I believe that would be the case with the Hobbins child case as well. where the killer slipped in through the garage into the locked door and then crept up into their bedroom in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
Now, the next question we have to address, Captain, would be, did the killer know his victims? And if not, why did he choose these particular people or houses?
And I guess you can throw in with that question, what is his motive?
Yeah, I think you could. For me, anyway, I mean, my answer is pretty much this. I don't think that this guy knew his victims at all. I think that these were probably crimes of opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
I think this guy was hell-bent on rape and murder. So when we talk about motive, let's first jump to motive. I think this guy was hell-bent on rape and murder. I think that's what I see here.
Right.
I don't think he snuck into the Bennett home for any other reason. He wasn't there to steal anything. He was there to attack whoever was in that home. I don't think he knew who was there.
Right, and you're saying it's a crime of opportunity because if their garage door was open, then
yeah.
it could be as simple as this guy's trolling neighborhoods. Oh, that garage door's open.
Yeah.
Let me go in there.
He goes out at 2, 3 in the morning under the cover of darkness, finds a home that happened to leave their garage door open.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the thing. I would, you know, maybe, you know, that theory could be proved wrong, whether these garage doors were left open or not. I think there's evidence to point that they were, in fact, open. Therefore, to me, for a victim that he wanted to target to happen to leave their garage door open, the probability of that is crazy. You can't even start to think about those numbers. So this, to me, is a crime of opportunity. How does this carry over to Patricia Smith and to Donna Dixon? I think he saw those two driving. We know they were both returning to their home shortly before both attacks occurred.
Yeah, so he'd be out trolling, you know, for maybe possible situations later in the day, and he just sees these females.
Yeah, and I mean, they're attractive ladies that are driving. They're returning to their home, both brunettes. I don't know if he had a type or not. It's tough to say that he had a type. Mm-hmm. when I'm also saying that he just picked houses because they happened to leave garage doors open.
Mm-hmm. Well, but with two of the victims, mm-hmm. he saw them driving.
Yeah. And I think that it's just that simple. I think this guy, I mean, you're talking about if it was in fact the same guy. We know three of the attacks were, but let's lump in the fourth one.
Well, right. But what I'm arguing is that you could kind of say that maybe he does have a type because he saw these two, you know, these two females driving, and he didn't. I mean, he probably saw multiple females driving.
Oh, I get what you're
saying.
He chose
these two.
He chose to follow those two.
Yeah, and they look similar. I mean, one's a little older, but, you know, they do look similar.
And the reason why I pick the motive is, and I know it seems like I'm kind of not giving a great answer here for motive, but I don't think it's crazy to suggest that this guy was just hell-bent on murder and rape. You're talking about four attacks in the course of 13 days.
Uh-huh.
That is somebody that has already spiraled out of control. This is somebody that is attacking at a frequency that is unheard of.
Well, and this kind of answers the next question, you know, mm-hmm. why were some attacks, you know, during the day and some at night? And really, like you were saying, it could just be opportunity.
Yeah, we can't really, whenever the opportunity arises for him, whenever he doesn't have to be accountable for his time or whereabouts,
right.
And he sees a potential victim, whether it be women that he's followed in cars or homes that appear easy to get into,
uh-huh.
he strikes. And that makes him an extremely dangerous and scary
individual. Yeah.
We're talking about nice communities too. And whether it be a nice community, poor community, bad community, whatever, these are vicious, horrible crimes.
Yeah. So then I guess the final question is, then why did they stop? I mean, obviously this person is a monster. A monster like this just doesn't just stop.
Because they seemingly have stopped. And when we say that, you know, the thing here is they have stopped in that area. And we can say that for certain. The other thing is they have his DNA and they have his DNA on file. If somebody crept into somebody's home in the middle of the night and murdered a family and left his DNA there, whether it be 15, 20 years later,
right,
on the other side of the country, we're going to know that this killer didn't stop.
So yeah, but they might have escalated.
You have a lot of factors to throw in there, I think.
Well, I think the first factor you throw in is that the last quote-unquote hammer slayer attack, that, you know, again, Bruce put up one hell of a fight. And maybe he, maybe this murderer said, you know what? That's too risky. I can't take that chance anymore. This hammer thing doesn't make any sense anymore. Because if I'm faced with somebody like Bruce again, I might not come out the victor.
Right.
And so they could change, you know, the way in which they, the weapon they use in the murders.
They could change the weapon that they use or stop altogether. The intruder also may have occurred an injury during that, because you're right to point out the Bennett. And I don't think that there, I think that, that there's plenty of proof there that there's good reason why that potentially may have been the last attack, or certainly the last known attack, because the major thing that's different between that attack and the previous three attacks is he actually has to fight with somebody.
Yeah.
We got to put in some other factors here. So it's 1984, right? It's we don't know much about DNA at the time. Yeah, they collected it at two of the crime scenes. He may have left it, most likely left it as a result of the rapes that occurred at those two crime scenes. The thing here is, though, that I keep kind of going back to is this guy, whoever was doing this, these are extremely risky crimes that this guy is committing. These are extremely risky attacks and murders that he's committing. We have two where he enters a home in the middle of the night and presumably doesn't know what's on the other side of that door.
Yeah.
He doesn't know how many people were in the home, doesn't know if there's dogs in the home, to our knowledge. I would consider that an extremely risky event. The other thing is the other two crimes happened during the daytime. One where he attacks a woman in her garage. Yeah, she may have arrived at home by herself, but you don't know if there's somebody inside that home.
Right.
Same with Patricia Smith, who came home. She happened to come home by herself, and there happened to be nobody inside the home. I think what may have occurred here, and this is pure speculation on my part, but I think that Bruce, God bless him, I think he injured this guy in some manner during the fight that took place in the Bennett household.
Yeah.
I think this guy might have been injured and chose to move elsewhere or attack elsewhere because of this injury. I think that the injury could have been a giveaway. I think this guy was actually either apprehended or killed at another attempted murder scene later.
Yeah, because chances are he's breaking into places. So he could have broken into a place, had the cops called. He went to jail for burglary or breaking and entering. They didn't know he was a murderer. But also, during this time period, they didn't collect DNA. So if you're arrested now, they're going to collect DNA, put you on file. But this is before this mandate. So he would have to have been arrested before that mandate. Now, did he get out and just kind of stop? Who knows? I would say that somebody like this, this kind of monster, is probably not going to stop. The other question here, too, is, you know, it seems like his motivation was, you know, sexual in nature. So was there an opportunity? The garage door is open. He goes in, struggles, has this fight. And then there's kids involved. And is that just enough for this monster to come back after the attack? Know that his time is running out. And maybe with these kids involved, decides to take his own life. That's a possibility as well.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think suicide, maybe, like I said, I believe it's a person that's already spiraled out of control before some of these attacks occurred.
Right.
Yeah, suicide could be very likely. Again, I think that if he didn't kill himself, that you're looking at a situation where the frequency of these attacks, I wouldn't expect him to stop. I would expect him to continue to attack and probably fairly soon. Maybe because
escalate more.
Well, maybe because of the injury that I believe may have occurred at the Bennett house, that he took some time off, let's say, to recover. I think that for somebody, a little psychological thing here, that I would throw in is somebody willing to enter a home and that does not know what's going on in that home or who is in that home or what weapons that the members of that family may have. This might be somebody that's very confident in their physical ability. And when they sustain an injury, they may be limited in the sense where they for a temporarily are not confident in their physical ability. They take some time off and then attempt another one of these high risk crimes by entering someone's home or attacking someone in broad daylight in another location. And the police didn't connect the two. And maybe he went off and spent some time in prison, and maybe it was a lengthy prison sentence. Mm-hmm. By the time he gets out, he's no longer confident in his physical ability because he's older, or maybe some injuries occurred while in prison, or maybe he passed away during that prison sentence.
Yeah.
All kinds of factors here.
I think the only thing that we have to go off of is a couple things. One, the letters, the bloody letters. So I would say anybody that's listening to this case that is from that area, from Lakewood or Aurora.
Or Denver. Maybe this guy worked in Denver and traveled to these areas to attack.
But think about this. You know, round 84, did a family member of yours commit suicide? Did a family member of yours go away for a time period? Maybe passed away in jail? Or maybe one was sick and passed away. Mm-hmm. But maybe this family member or a friend of a friend was a little kind of shady. Do these letters, do you want to go over those letters again real quick?
Do they mean anything to anybody out there listening? And the first guess was PETAW-C. And the next set of letters was RICHAR. And anyone with information should contact the Aurora Police Detectives at 303-739-6106 or the Lakewood Police Cold Case Hotline at 303-987-7474. All right, Captain, we want to thank everybody for listening.
Thanks for filling up the fridge. Thanks for all those little donations. You know, it helps keep the heat on in the garage, and it's freaking cold, my friends.
Mm-hmm. So everybody, you stay warm out there. Until next time, be good, be kind, and don't litter.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.